Well, good morning, everyone. It is a blessing to be here. I have brought with me a wooden gavel. What does that represent to you?
Authority.
And where? I'm American. Not Canadian, so we'll see how much of the two cultures jive on the gavel. Where would you picture a gavel? In a court. Court of law, I assume? Court of law, where we have a... Who holds the gavel?
Judge.
A judge. Where else might we find a gavel?
Auctioneer.
An auctioneer? I'd be familiar with that as well. Anywhere else that you're thinking?
Teacher Inspiration Day.
Teacher Inspiration Day. Yes, I was hoping you wouldn't miss the obvious. Exactly. There's one other place in the United States government that would have a gavel. In a lot of the Senate sessions, the speaker would have a gavel that he would bring the class to order, bring the court to order. So the gavel represents authority, and I've sort of been intrigued at the train of thought that we've had so far this morning. We talked to, or implied, if not outright, spoke about authority. And we'll start bringing this closer to our classrooms in just a bit. We looked at where it's used, who uses it. I'm going to go back to my American roots a little bit in the courtroom, and you'll just have to bear with me if it's different in Canada. But, this gavel, depending who's holding it, and depending on the situation and what state you're in, you could be sentenced to death with the rap of this gavel. You could be sentenced to life in prison with the tap of this gavel. You could be sentenced with a mortgage with a tap of this gavel if you're buying a property from an auctioneer. Or possibly, in a lighter picture, you see this good deal at an auction and you're the last bidder and you're like, please just drop the gavel so I can buy it. I want it before anybody else puts bids on. And that's a happy day, I suppose. So there's a lot of emotion that's wrapped up in this. And if you can picture yourself in a courtroom, and if you would find yourself in the unfortunate situation in which you're, at least in our terms, involved in a lawsuit, and the judge would rule against you, whether it be a sum of money or prison time for some scenario, and the moments before the court reads the order, whether you're guilty or not guilty, how do you think you'd be feeling? And this, at least in the States, is months, if not years long process that builds up to the moment in which the court decides if you're guilty or not guilty. If it's a serious case, how might your emotions be? I'd like to hear just a little bit of feedback from you. Very uptight, very nervous, because in the next few moments, your destiny is going to be decided with the tap of this gavel. Are there limitations to this? Or is this supreme authority? Depends who holds it, absolutely. But even in the case of who holds it, are there limitations?
A judge has to operate within the Constitution.
Absolutely. A judge has to operate within, actually a judge has a very, very narrow delegation of his authority. He can't just look out the window and say, hey, I think that car is speeding, go arrest him. He can't do that. That's outside of his authority. But if somebody is disrupting his court session in his courtroom, he can have the marshal arrest them. That's within his authority. So there's limitations. What does delegate mean? I have a definition for you if you want to jot it down. Delegate simply means to entrust a task or responsibility to another person. Delegate it out. To entrust a task or a responsibility to another person. And it's typically, well, you answer this one. Does it go up or down? Delegation in authority. Does authority rise with delegation or lower with delegation? It lowers. So if you are delegating, you're often the person that has a higher form of authority or a higher level of authority than the one that you're delegating this task or responsibility to. Now, hopefully your minds are spinning down your position in the classroom. You also have a gavel. You have delegated authority. That authority has definite limitations. Maybe we should define authority. What would you give to the definition of authority? I have another one here for you. The power or right to give orders, make decisions, and enforce obedience. That's authority. The power or right to give orders, make decisions, and enforce obedience. Now, if you think about that definition, the power or right to do something, that in itself implies delegation, doesn't it? Because where did it come from? Where did this power or right to give orders come from? You had to receive it. That's implied. In some form or another, whether you were elected, whether you were appointed by somebody, what, lower or higher than you? By somebody higher than you. You were appointed. So by its very definition, I found that fascinating to think about. By its very definition, the word authority implies delegation. So then we have to ask the question, who does this come from? Well, you might think about it in your classroom. You were hired, you were given the charge by probably a school board or a school board member or a ministerial team, and possibly even the school board would sort of answer to a ministerial team of the church and the church to there, and we can go out there. You can go to the civil realm, and you think about the police officer, and you think about the various levels of enforcement and government, and you work yourself to the top of that, and then what? Beyond the prime minister or the president, where do you have to go next? I mean, they're not immortal. Eventually, all authority answers to God. God being the supreme authority. And so, as we realize that, we are all under God's authority, and I appreciated the emphasis we heard already, that kings answer to God's authority. Kings are in God's authority. How much more would you and I be in our little classrooms, in our little country schools? That's an humbling thought for me. So since authority is delegated, and since all authority goes back to God ultimately, there's something else that really impressed itself on my mind, and that was the idea of stewardship. God gives us things, right, to steward well, whether it be physical possessions. But what about authority? And y'all, as teachers, is not your authority that you have in your classroom something to steward and be careful with and to use well and to use wisely? Ever think about that? This isn't your classroom to reign supreme in. You can't just do with your students whatever you wake up one morning and feel like doing, even though easier said than done sometimes. I've been there. So I had to wonder, how well am I stewarding the authority that God has given me? And then I was thinking down this train further, and I said, well, how do I know how to be a steward of it? And I started looking up a few Bible verses that I found absolutely amazing, and my mind started going down the line of, how does God, well, let's go to our superior. How does our board handle their authority? How does our ministries handle theirs and our parents? And we can gain good truths from that. But let's work the whole way back up to God. How does God handle his authority? He doesn't answer to anybody. So is God like a ruthless dictator? Well, he could be, I suppose. He could be. And human thought, but he isn't. And how do we know he's not? If you have your Bibles, I would just love to flip through a few verses, starting in Psalms. And as we move through these verses, I want you to be putting your name in the place of God speaking here. And I want you to let your thoughts travel. How am I doing? Could I put my name into these verses and say, this is my student talking. Nolan is my shepherd. I shall not want, out of Psalm 23. Is that how they view you? This is David speaking of his authority in his life, of God in his life. Psalm 23. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He restores my soul. Does that describe you in your classroom? Psalm 103, verse 13. Picking out a few verses that describe God, or else God specifically speaking to the children of Israel. Psalm 103, 13. Like as a father pitieth his children, so the Lord pitieth them that fear him. Like as a father pities his children, Deuteronomy 32. Deuteronomy, here is one out of God in relation to the children of Israel. Deuteronomy 32, verse 10. He found him in a desert land, in the waste howling wilderness. He led him about, he instructed him, he kept him as the apple of his eye. And the mental picture I got there was from an upper grade brother teacher. And I'm picturing about a seventh or eighth grade boy. That's just a handful. Could this describe you and your administration in your classroom? That you found him in a desert land, and you led him, and you instructed him, and you kept him as the apple of your eye. That's what God did. I have more here, but two more yet. Isaiah. There's a couple beautiful verses in Isaiah. Isaiah 41. Isaiah 41, 10 to 13. I might just skim through here again. This is God talking. Fear not, Isaiah 41, 10. For I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will strengthen thee. I will help thee, I will uphold thee with the right hand. Behold, everything that was against them, just paraphrasing now, went by the wayside because God was helping. For I, the Lord thy God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. And somehow I just go to this side. Younger grade teachers, does this describe you in your classroom? And the petrified little second or third grader that for whatever fear they have today, you get down beside them, and this is how you relate to the young child that again has this fear that you already covered three and four times already, and now again today, they're just freaked out of their minds for some reason or another. Maybe it's their lesson that they don't think they can do How are you handling your authority? I'd like to look at Luke 7 as a bit of a case study on authority, if you would flip there. Luke 7. So again, being amazed at God's, if I can say, stewarding his own authority on behalf of his people. Take a look at this story here. In Luke chapter 7, I'm going to have to paraphrase again here for sake of time. But here we have a centurion. And just refresh your memory. What is a centurion? A Roman leader of 100 soldiers. Centurion. And why don't you just tell us a story? What happens next? So we have this centurion, then what? What happened? You know your Bible knowledge well enough here. It's a fascinating story. Quickly.
His servant got sick.
And who got sick again?
His servant.
His servant, not his son, or his daughter, or his wife, or his dad, or his mom. His servant got sick. Think about that. His servant got sick. And he was so moved by his servant's sickness that what did he do? He went to Jesus for help. So what kind of centurion would do that? But it must have been a way of life. What other details do we have as to the character of this centurion? I know you didn't have time to look over this real much, but if you look at verse 3, the Jews heard that he was beseeching Jesus, and what did the Jews do? I guess it was pretty rare, I think. What did they do? Yes.
They commented him and said he was worthy.
Well, they referred him to Jesus, like, Jesus, you really should do something about this, because he is worthy, and why? What had he done for the Jews? Just call it out. Verse 5, two things.
Built a synagogue.
And he loved their nation, and he built us a synagogue. That was really special for the Jewish people. That meant a lot. But that's not the only thing he did. I'm failing to lay my eyes on it, but what else did he do? Something else in my mind here. Something about his generosity. I was thinking, I mentioned somewhere that he gave alms. Maybe that was another passage. I'm not seeing it at the moment. But anyway, he seemed to be a very, very generous person, especially for the people that was in his care. And what was his view of authority? He was a powerful man. He was. Somebody just put it in your own words. What was his view of his authority?
He was under others' authority.
Oh, he specifically said that, right? Didn't he? He said, I'm under authority, but I also have authority. He recognized both at the same time. He said, I have authority here. I got 100 men reporting to me, but I'm also under authority. And he said, I could tell this my one man to go here, and I can tell another one to come. They have to listen to me. What was his point in saying and telling Jesus that? Was he like bragging, like he's a powerful man? What point was this centurion trying to make to Jesus?
Was he saying, I believe you have power over devils and sicknesses?
Right. So he was saying, look, on a natural sense, I got this little bit of authority. I have 100 men. I can tell them to go and come as I see best, and I'm also under authority. How much more, Jesus, can you just take this situation? You're much more powerful than I am. And what was Jesus' response?
He told the friends that the centurion had sent to Jesus on his behalf, that he had not found so great a favor.
Right. Jesus was, I think, in our human sense, just blown away with what an attitude coming from a Roman centurion. What an attitude. What a beautiful character that we have here that you wouldn't really expect to find. Think of yourself in your classroom again. If you would have a need, would your students rally around you? Now, I know that's probably a terrible question. I was pondering that as I was saying it. That's not what governs your classroom. But in other words, is that the kind of rapport that you have with the people in your life? How are you stewarding this authority? And we might as well be honest as teachers here. I think we struggle with this a good bit. And maybe it's more the long-term teachers. I don't know. I see that in myself and as I watch teachers. That sometimes I think we can slowly over years start morphing into something that we didn't start out with. And I think it's just good to stop and think, how are we stewarding our authority in the classroom? And maybe you're new to teaching and you got these ambitions, I'm gonna do this, gonna do that, and this community just needs some help and I think I can provide this. Education's down, dads aren't focused, and we're gonna get this thing in shape. You know as well as I do, or you will know eventually if you don't know. Everything that I've been describing in the last minute or so here about how we think, I boil down to one word, and I would like to just consider briefly a core issue that I think makes all the difference of how we view ourselves, and that is the word identity. And that's a question I would just challenge you with. Where is your identity? You can figure it out pretty quick. It's not real hard. Not real hard at all. Sister teachers, mom calls you up, stops in, and maybe she's just a little bit stressed and doesn't come across real patient, and she got a bone to pick with you. And we'll give the benefit to the mom that she was good-hearted. It was just a bad morning for her, and unfortunately, she wasn't real prudent and dumped it out on you. How do you take that? Does that seriously grind your gears and make you have a bad day? Or school board comes and says, like, hey, you know, we appreciate what you're doing, but this and this, and at least we men, we just kind of bristle at that. It's like, look, I was working hard, 80 hours school weeks and or more, and I'm trying, don't you see? I would just venture to say that if your identity is being a school teacher, you're going to be in for a rough road. Really rough road. If your identity is in how your students perform and how they look and how they can dance to your tune, you're going to have a rough road. If your identity is tied up in how those 9th and 10th graders exit your classroom and how they make out in life, and that grades how you feel about yourself and how successful you believe yourself to be, that's going to be a dead-end street as well. If it's in your personal talent, if it's in your personal skill set, that's where your identity is. You really feel good about yourself because you can just teach like a pro. I mean, students love you, everything's going well. But see, what happens then when you get tapped on the shoulder or when you get criticized and your identity is in the thing that's criticized, that's where the pain comes from and can knock you off your rocker. And so I would argue there has to be something else. There has to be something else in which all of us, whether you're in any form of leadership, you have to find your identity somewhere in a concept that cannot be shaken by anybody under the sun. Where am I headed with that? Where do we have to have our identity settled?
In Christ.
And we don't have time here to look at Ephesians 2 real in depth, but if you want to jot it down, Ephesians 2 is my favorite passage. If you're feeling lost personally and trying to figure out where you're at, maybe you got the props knocked out underneath you from the school board or from your a mom or a patron that you really admired, and here it just came in a little hard and you're just all over the place. Or maybe it's your students that are not performing to your standard of excellence, and you're just struggling. It's like, come on, I was a better teacher than this. And again, fourth grade got a failing grade, and I don't know what's wrong. I taught them, and we reviewed it. It can't be my fault, that's for sure, because I did all the right things. Well, check out Ephesians 2, and remember where you came from. That would be a point that maybe you could jot down. Remember where you came from. And I hope that if you're a school teacher especially, and it doesn't even matter if you are or aren't, I hope that all of you here have a personal relationship with Christ. You have to. And assuming that you have, don't ever forget where you came from. You were dead in trespasses and sins. And you might think, verse 2 and 3 just describe your students perfectly. Well, you used to be there. You did. You used to be there. Whether it's that age or that maturity level, whatever. But praise God for verse 4. It's such a beautiful verse. But God, who is rich in mercy, for his great love wherewith he loved us, even while we were dead in sins, even when you were getting 50% on your math grade and failing and being rebellious and hard to deal with, God in his supreme authority reached down to each of us here and pulled us up from that as we surrendered our life to him. But we find it so hard to turn around and do that to our students. Life gets real, and we're stressed and we're loaded. And sometimes we just lose that vision. Where did I come from? I used to be that student. I did. I used to be that student. But thank God for maturity and age and his redemptive work on our behalf is the reason I am what I am. But now it's my turn. I'm in a position now where I can reach and pull others along with me. Read over chapter 2. It's a beautiful text. So how does one embrace delegated authority? Maybe I should just think just a little bit more on the delegated part. I mentioned it briefly at the beginning. We said that the gavel definitely has its limitations for a judge, an auctioneer, a senator has to operate within the limits. And when you think about your very limited role as a teacher, we have a supreme God, shakes down through a bunch of levels till we get to a local area of believers that creates a church, that creates a school that the patrons rally around, that they realize all of a sudden they need teachers for, because need somebody to teach these students. And so they hired you to teach somebody on a lower level of authority than you. So do you get the picture of where you are in this? Now, I'd like to narrow that field even more, just to give us a reality check. I assume it's the same in Canada as it is in the States, that you are hired for one room, if it's multiple rooms at school. Your authority doesn't even, unless you're a lead teacher or have more influence in other rooms, but your authority doesn't even reach to the other rooms too much. Your domain is pretty much your four walls of your classroom. So it takes a working together with faculty, with board, with church, And it was mentioned already this morning, you know, how we view the authority over us makes a big difference how well we'll be able to connect with our students. And you know, the exciting thing that I love to watch in a classroom is as you, as a teacher, have a proper role of authority and support those over you, it's an amazing thing, especially in upper grades, to be able to start handing authority to your students. Ever try that? Within your bounds of authority. But you know what? When are students going to start learning how to be self-disciplined, how to be managers of their own schedules? And you can start saying, hey, here is your slot for you to work in. Go for it. I'm here to coach you. I'm here to help you. That turns the light bulbs on. Just a practical example. I don't know if you do like a school yearbook or a newspaper or something. But I just always love to see the gears turning and the lights come on in 8th, 9th, 10th grade levels. They're like, I'm like, hey, you're the chairman. That's your problem, not mine. Like, okay. All right. Well, then they go back to their table and they keep working. And it starts connecting things in their mind. And look, they have to take personal responsibility for this thing. How do we embrace this? I already mentioned never forget where you came from. Another way you could embrace this delegated authority that is yours is to create a mission statement for your authority. Now, that might be a new thought for you. I didn't do it till I taught grades 6 and 7 for 4 years, and then grades 8, 9, and 10 for 3. And when I moved to the upper grade level is when somebody had shared that with me, and I jotted down I thought about it a good deal. I was like, what do I actually want? What is my goal as upper grade teacher and as the lead teacher of a school with about 80 students? I have a huge amount of influence here. I'm going to have to stay on target, not get distracted, not go down bunny trails too far. What am I about as the upper grade teacher? So you can jot mine down, and I would encourage you to morph it into something that applies to you. But here was mine in the last couple years that I taught. I wanted to graduate youth who were socially well-adjusted, ingrained with a kingdom mindset, and informed with enough worldly wisdom to be competent assets in society. It's a sort of a three-pronged approach. I wanted them to be socially adjusted, a kingdom mindset that's ingrained in their minds. It's just a way of life. That's how they think. And then enough worldly knowledge, and I'm thinking scholastically, intellectually, to be able to be competent assets in society. That was what I wanted. And that was what I worked for all the years that they would come up through. That's what I was watching for. Until they graduated my room, that was my goal for them. Individually. That doesn't come your first year, and probably not your second. So don't twist yourself in the pretzels if you're a new teacher and you're like, I don't even know how to teach math, let alone make a mission statement for myself. So it comes with experience, it really does. But I would encourage you, if you have a few years behind you, to start thinking, what am I actually about as a teacher? Why am I here? Why am I teaching these students? What do I want to see when they're out of my care? Maybe just a short side note. One of the first things I thought of when I received this assignment was, I remember so well my first day of teaching. How many first-year teachers here? All right. God bless you. First year teachers, I'm glad you're here because that means you're still going. But that first year is a struggle, especially when you think about the authority thing. And I don't know, sometimes I wish, I'll just throw this out for what it's worth, chew on it, see what you think. I wish somehow that our homes and churches could do just a little better at training at least our young men to be a little bit more responsible, a little bit more okay with authority in their own lives. Because here's what happens. You Maybe I'm just judging you by myself, but we grow up in our sheltered Mennonite homes, which is an incredible blessing. We get 18, 19, 20-year-old young men that have lived in that umbrella pretty tightly all their lives, maybe worked at home possibly, and now all of a sudden are thrown into a classroom of 15, dozen students of some kind and run it. Be good at it. That's a jump. That's a massive jump, and even for younger grade teachers as well, I'm sure. And now you have all these youngsters in your care, and what am I to do with it? Mom always took care of me before. Now I'm here and having to do this, like overnight, just like that. I often said, and nothing makes you grow up faster than jumping in a classroom of adolescent children. It's like, wow, it's a good experience, it is. But I really have a heart for first-year teachers, especially upper grade teachers, 19, 20-year-olds that might get, I've heard of even situations in smaller schools are starting to threaten the principal position. Like, wow, how do you pull that off? Outlying area, not used to, you know, being in the community there. So I feel for you a lot. And I don't know if there's any clear answers on that. You just have to do it, I guess. Jump in. My brother is teaching for the first year in an outlying community, and it wasn't the smoothest transition. First year teacher, 21, something in that range. Anyway, I asked him, I said, like, how did you make out? How did you get through your first couple of days? Like, how do you view yourself in your classroom? It's so new. You're so desperate for the students to like you. And I say that with all sincerity. We might as well just own it. That's it. We're just trying to survive as new teachers. You have to have your students on board. And if they're not, it's an absolute nightmare. Can be. And so you're about ready to do anything just to keep your classroom with you. But at some point, you have to be able to lead. You have to be able to lead. And I keep coming back, even for new teachers, I think identity is the biggest thing. If you're going to hold your identity in your performance, you're going to get crushed. You have to be willing to take the blows, take the heat, take the discouragement, and know that your identity is still in Christ, and you will pull through. Guarantee you, you will pull through. So just a shout out to the first year teachers. It's a big jump. The great tragedy of life comes not in failing to reach goals. Can you finish it? But in failing to make goals and having no goals to reach. The great tragedy of life is not failing to reach goals, but in having no goals to reach. So you're going to stumble. That's part of it. Keep going. Keep going. And it's good to have an aim. You have to know where you're headed. And again, this comes second, third year maybe, teachers. Where are you going? If I was to walk back the center aisle and I want to go out those back doors, am I going to be worried about the people seated on this side and on this side? If there's a clear path? Not really. I know they're there. But that's in my peripheral. I have an aim. I'm headed out those back doors. The main thing I'm going to worry about, if there's any people in the back that's going to be in my way that I have to get through. I have to figure out how to deal with that. So as a teacher, if you have an aim in your classroom, all the peripheral stuff just sort of stays there, and this is the goal that you want. That's what you shoot for. So how are you stewarding your gavel in your classroom? Another quote for you. When the uncapped potential of a student meets the liberating art of a teacher, that's when a miracle unfolds. I'll read that again. When the uncapped potential of a student meets the liberating art of a teacher, or the liberating art of teaching, maybe you could say, that's when a miracle unfolds. Another quote. When love and skill work together, expect a masterpiece. When love and skill work together, expect a masterpiece. In closing, if we could turn to Isaiah 40. Isaiah 40, verse 11. I saved my favorite verse till last. Isaiah 40, verse 11. Why don't we read this together? Isaiah 40, verse 11, all together. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall carry the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom and shall gently lead those that are with young. If nothing else, maybe that could be your mission statement for your classroom. Does that describe you? Is that how your patrons would describe you? Feed his flock like a shepherd. This is not cookie cutter work, and I think that's another pitfall teachers can fall into sometimes. This is not cookie cutter work. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. This is God, supreme authority, feeding his flock and gathers the lambs in with his arm and carries them and gently leads those that are with young. So today, I'd like to remind you of your responsibility, your delegated authority that you have in your classroom to keep order and to build those relationships. Go back to your sphere where you're responsible for. And keep this Isaiah 40, 11 in mind. That would be my prayer for you as you go back, that you'd be able to lead your classroom with a shepherd's heart. That's what your students need, a shepherd's heart, and feed your flock well.